This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, I'm Paul Barclay, and this is Big Ideas on RN and online. Has racism entered the political mainstream in Australia, or is its influence found only among fringe far-right extremist groups and lone wolves? Virtually everyone in politics and the media condemns racism, but there's disagreement about how widespread and structural racism is. Depending on who you ask, it exists in Australia as in any other country and is restricted to individuals. Others say discrimination against race is intrinsic and needs tackling on a societal level. Here are four different perspectives on the question. We start with Tim Soupamasan, political theorist and former race discrimination officer at the Australian Human Rights Commission.
The resurgence of racism and extremism in the form of white nationalism and racial supremacism represent, in my view, a direct threat to our democracy today. And I believe there's a responsibility that all of us as citizens and members of an Australian democracy have in responding to this challenge and threat. So my view is very simple. I do believe that racism has entered into the Australian mainstream, and it is vitally important that it is now confronted and combated. And the events, the tragic events in Christchurch, only bring to attention just what can happen if we allow for forms of hate and racial speech to escalate into something much more dangerous. It is a reminder of the connection between hate speech and political violence. I would have hoped that in the aftermath of the Christchurch terror attack that we might have seen a resetting of our political debate in Australia. That we might, for example, have seen leadership in the form of a strengthening of our hate speech laws, that there may have been a new government commitment to an anti-racism strategy or initiative at the national level, that there may have been a stop to race politics as it has been practiced in recent years. I don't think we've seen that reset just yet. I would hope that we see something of a restoration of sanity and proportionate public debate in our national life, because if I can be frank, we haven't seen much of that in recent years, and it has contributed to the emergence of far-right extremism and to a threat to democracy, as I've described in the form of racism. Let me lay out the evidence for why I believe racism has returned to mainstream public debate in Australia. And I believe there can be evidence identified in the realms of politics and government, in the realms of media, and also more generally in the language that we are using to discuss race and racism right now in our political culture. 2018, for me, represented a year when we saw the unfortunate normalisation of hate in our political debate. If we cast our minds back to the start of last year, you may recall, of course, the panic that was generated around African gangs. Home Affairs Minister Peter Dutton declared that Melburnians were afraid to go out to dinner because of rampant African youth crime. We saw as well last year various calls by leading politicians for an arguable departure to our non-racially discriminatory immigration policy. Minister Dutton, again, called for a dedicated stream or special attention for white South African farmers to be admitted under Australia's refugee program. Tony Abbott called for a complete halt to African immigration. Two examples, I would argue, of a departure from the principle of non-discrimination when it concerns the conduct of Australia's immigration policy. We've seen as well very disturbing examples of white supremacist language being used in the federal parliament itself. Last August, Fraser Anning, in his maiden speech to the Senate, talked about the need for a final solution to Australia's immigration problem, as he termed it. Final solution, drawing on Nazi language that was used to describe the extermination of Jews. And while there was condemnation of that speech, just 2 months later in the federal parliament, Pauline Hanson would move a motion to endorse the idea that it was okay to be white, a white supremacist slogan. And she was supported in that motion by 23 government senators in that vote. And if you look to 2019 and the debates that we've had this year already, think about what we've seen in the debate we've had about the Medivac legislation, where senior government ministers have been warning about murderers and rapists running rampant in Australian society. That's not a characterisation of what they said. That's precisely the language they used to describe that legislative issue. And then there's the casual racism that we start seeing more frequently now among our elected representatives. Senator Ian MacDonald of Queensland, in a Senate hearing, asked a question about whether Penny Wong was related to the Chinese-Australian businessman Huang Ximao because of the apparent similarity in their surnames. Barry O'Sullivan used the racial slur Chinaman in a Senate estimates hearing. And on the Labor side, in the recent New South Wales state election, we had Michael Daly referring to Asians with PhDs posing a threat to local jobs in New South Wales. That's the evidence I would put forward for the normalisation of racism in our politics. But it doesn't end there. If we look at how media covers issues of race, we again see signs of a normalisation of hatred and prejudice. Just after the Christchurch terror attack, if you were to look at the media's response to that, among the responses was a front page by the Courier Mail, which had a picture of the gunman, the Australian white supremacist, and it was labelled working class madman, which I think many interpreted as something of an attempt to humanise the murderer and terrorist in focusing attention on his backstory as a working class boy and the kind of childhood that he had in Australia. Then you look at some of the commentary we've seen over the past year. Andrew Bolt has led the way, describing a tidal wave of immigration overwhelming Australia, such that we no longer know who is us and who is them. He's described the formation of ethnic colonies by Jewish, Chinese, and Indian migrants. If you switch on the television after dark on Sky News, you see regular rehearsals of lazy, prejudice, and offensive speech of a racial kind. Ross Cameron, one of the co-hosts of the Outsiders program, was sacked after some comments he made about Chinese people. His fellow co-host, Rowan Dean, once told me to go back to Laos, where my family is from, because he disagreed with comments I made about the lack of diversity in Australian public institutions, including the media. And then you turn on the TV on in the morning and you watch breakfast television, where the likes of Pauline Hanson and Mark Latham are regular paid panellists on the Sunrise program. These are the signs of a normalisation of hate. And it's starting to come through now in how we talk about racism. There's emerged this false equivalence now between racism on the one hand and anti-racism on the other. Some are even comparing reformist environmentalism with the threat of white nationalism, as we've seen in the past 2 weeks with the description that the Greens Party poses an equivalent threat to our society as One Nation. And we've seen as well the idea emerge that free speech must mean the toleration of hate speech. The idea that people have a right to vent their bigotry. This all came, of course, from 2014 when the then Attorney General George Brandis sought to change Section 18C of the Racial Discrimination Act. That was the language that was used to describe the push to change our racial hatred laws. We've unfortunately seen the emergence of a particular kind of identity politics on free speech in Australian society. And by this, I don't mean the usual identity politics that some in the conservative media like to identify. Rather, this is an identity politics that is all about white nationalism and about putting minorities in their place when they dare speak out against racism. The reasons for this are various. We have seen, of course, the rise of nationalist populism across the globe. The Trump presidency has emboldened those on the right of politics to think about shifting towards more extreme positions in order to capture more support. We've seen as well fragmentation in the media industry shape the way they cover racial and related issues. Quite simply, what we're seeing is a monetization of hate. As technology undermines traditional and legacy media, we're starting to see now efforts to cling on to audiences through the confection of conflict and the amplification of prejudice. How must we respond toward this? Well, for one, we need to ensure that we continue to have effective laws against racial discrimination and hatred. Laws on their own do not eradicate social evils, of course. We've had laws against murder and rape and theft for thousands of years. Those have not been eradicated. But that is no reason for us to repeal laws against murder or rape or theft. So it must be on racism too. We must not be winding back laws against racism. We must as well tackle all forms of extremism more seriously. We have perhaps been complacent about the threat that's been posed by far-right, white nationalist and racial supremacist movements. But the problem is broader than that. We've got to educate all members of our society to understand what racism means, the legacies involved in our colonial history, the institutional racism that still exists for many members of our society, most notably Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Australians. But perhaps most of all, we need to be more honest in our conversations about race. All too often, we engage in denial or deflection about racism. Too often, we're told that we are the most successful multicultural society in the world, as though that means that racism doesn't exist. But the two are not mutually incompatible or exclusive. I believe we are a successful multicultural society, but racism also exists within it. Our success and our progress is not yet complete, and we must ensure that we work harder to complete that project. Because what's at stake is this: when racism occurs and thrives, it doesn't just do harm to those who are its targets, it doesn't just hurt minorities, it diminishes all of us, and it diminishes our society. And that's the challenge that we face today. If we are a democratic society that believes in the values of equality, tolerance, and non-discrimination, then we must confront racism in a full-throated way.
For Tasneem Chopra, it's not a question of if racism is a broader problem, but how deep it goes. She's a cross-cultural consultant on issues of cultural competence, gender leadership, and intersectional discrimination.
In the immediate aftermath of the Christchurch terror attack, I experienced both, I guess, a proximity that was geographic and spiritual in terms of the impact that I felt. I found my mind in two places, one of grief and mourning for the victims, but also one of rage for the fermenting narratives of hate and division from leadership enabled by media, which continues to fuel narratives of exclusion with particular consistency since 9/11. This consistency is widespread. And while the violent elements might exist on the far-right fringes, fundamentally, they are provided endorsement and legitimacy from structural racism that masquerades as national security. It is the beliefs and words that inform actions that cause hatred to manifest. Whether through word of mouth or cyberspace, the volatility of these words when given legitimacy of office, it carries substantive weight. Let me be clear, it was not the internet that killed innocent New Zealanders, but the radicalised mind of a white supremacist terrorist whose views were found to accord with right-wing extremists and who in his 74-page manifesto acknowledged as inspiration the kind of white supremacist thinking that some would argue underscored the genocide of this country's First Nations people over 200 years ago, and where racism continues to be experienced in both overt and covert ways. It's important to add that in appreciating the context of how political speak can privilege the oppressor, the pathologizing and the humanizing afforded to the suspect certainly irked a lot of people and viewers who caught that on the news. And as Tim mentioned, the luxury of being personified and humanized is not the kind of treatment that we afford to most terrorists that come on our screens. In 2017, there were 2,891 anti-Islamic articles published in Australia, according to an extensive report by One Path Network in Sydney, called Islam in the Media 2017. It followed coverage of five newspapers owned by News Limited, namely The Australian, The Daily Telegraph, The Herald Sun, The Courier Mail, and The Advertiser. And in these five newspapers, we found almost 3,000 articles in 1 year that referred to Islam or Muslims alongside words like violence, extremism, terrorism, or radicalization. That's 8 articles a day. Jason Wilson in The Guardian last month wrote that Islamophobia had practically been enshrined in public policy for the past few decades, with the vilifying of Islam and Muslims resembling a tabloid staple in certain quarters, with almost zero accountability or platform to counter these embedded and structural racisms. White nationalism in Australia is a component of its colonial legacy. Indeed, colonialism writ large across the globe by invading white nations for centuries has laid bare scars that we continue to reel from. Managing the Muslim migrant has become an extension of this, which post-colonial societies undertake in the name of sovereign control. In the past few years, we have seen the emergence of right-wing ideologies and parties and politicians like Pauline Hanson's One Nation, Reclaim Australia, the Australian Liberty Alliance, whose acronym of Allah I find quite ironic, Senator Corey Bernardi, and Fraser Anning, no less. And in addition to the Islamophobic messages they have perpetuated, and like in no particular order, I'm going to share some of the comments that I've observed and located based on statements and utterances from MPs. One in particular by Senator Brian Burston from New South Wales came from a letter he wrote to principals in his electorate. And this is an actual excerpt from the letter. In order to appreciate why Western civilization is not compatible to the Islamic world, you need to get an understanding of the history of Islam. This can best be obtained by reading Harry Richardson's The Story of Muhammad, Islam Unveiled. Islam is incompatible, and with the rejection of our British system of law and democracy, and their adherence to Sharia law, polygamy, forced marriages, resorting to supporting jihad, violence, and extortion by way of halal certification schemes, is further evidence of their incompatibility. For these reasons, Islam is incompatible with free-thinking Australians, and Australian culture, and Australian values and way of life. Islam is political, cultural, economic, a totalitarian regime, a supremacist ideology wrapped in the skin of religion, and there's more. Signed by, faithfully, Brian Burston, Senator of New South Wales. Then there was George Christensen, the federal MP from the Nationals, who agreed to speak at anti-Muslim rallies in 2016 under the banner of Respect Australia, where he advertised neo-Nazi slogans inadvertently. He also addressed a Reclaim Australia rally earlier in 2015, arguing he was defending freedom of speech with the myriad of all these anti-discrimination laws that were coming into place. Pauline Hanson in 2016, on her return to government, decried Australia is being swamped by Muslims. She advocated, amongst other things, for a Muslim ban, that Islam was not compatible with Australia, calling for a royal commission into Islam. I still don't know what that means. And that terrorism was caused by Muslim immigration. And of course, she did famously say, if we have a disease, and Islam is a disease, we vaccinate ourselves against it. Tony Abbott, our former PM and Minister of Women's Affairs and Indigenous Affairs, complained, when Muslim community leaders condemn terrorism, I wish they'd mean it. Islamophobia never killed anybody, even when it had. And of course, Peter Dutton's comments about Malcolm Fraser making mistakes bringing in migrants in the 1970s, referring to the Lebanese Muslims in Sydney. There are so many. But perhaps the more recent one, of course, was Fraser Anning, who of the Christchurch terror attacks said in their wake, what this highlights is the growing fear within our communities, both in Australia and New Zealand, of the increasing Muslim presence, effectively blaming Muslim immigration for their own murder. And let's not forget the seven coalition senators congratulating Anning immediately after his calling for a final solution to manage the Muslim problem in his maiden speech. Now, while Anning was last week censured in a momentous vote for his inhumane comments following the Christchurch attack, the symbolic day-long censure pales into comparison to the years of hateful bile piled onto Australian Muslims and other minorities, which we endure for the sake of advancing an elite agenda. Indeed, the rise and rise of right-wing conservatism gaining traction in Europe and the US has impacted the political landscape here. We've not been spared the bastion that is white privilege that seeks to manipulate systems and communities into this us and them dichotomy. In Trump's campaign alone prior to his appointment, he flagged issues of a Muslim ban, shutting down mosques, claimed the US was at war with Muslims, that Muslims hate us. And in the wake of his election in the counties where he spoke, Islamophobic attacks rose by 226%. For decades, Australian governments have demonstrated a deft culpability in the demonising of Muslims and Islam for political gain. From the Gulf War and Australian Muslims learning early on that guilt by association for all things Arab and Islamic demanded unequivocal condemnation, irrespective of our distance or connection to the issue. In the ensuing Children Overboard scandal, when Prime Minister John Howard lied about parents throwing their children overboard, though they never did, in order to back up their overzealous border protection policies, and when he famously quipped, as we know, we will decide who comes to this country and the circumstances in which they come, also culminating in an offshore detention centre for largely Muslim asylum seekers. Historically, there has been traction in getting votes by escalating fear of difference, leveraging duplicitous sloganisms like children overboard, stop the boats, go back to where you came from. And this is the thing. When persons occupying the highest office of the country and their colleagues across the parliamentary floor partake in demonising Muslim other and refugees and migrants as the forever outsider seen as the scourge of society, therefore ideally placed to blame for every economic or environmental woe that afflicts a nation, is it any wonder that hatred leads to aggression? Fast forward to today, we learnt that as recently as last year, the hate crimes unit in New South Wales was manned by a single officer. This begs the question, where is the political will and resource wherewithal to counter the consequences of hate-fueled ideology that can culminate in a domestic terror threat? It highlights the level of denial and culpability of state and media players with power, platform and legitimacy to look inward at how their Islamophobia, incitement of hatred and white supremacist views are placing ordinary Australians in great peril. The potential danger of far right-wing organisations who garner support from mainstream politicians of various persuasions has been dangerously minimised and therefore not taken as seriously with the government, police or media by focusing only on Islamist violence. What these far right entities stoke has consequences, and Christchurch is an example of 51 reasons why we need to re-examine the status quo. In Australia last year, we witnessed political leaders debate it's okay to be white, Senator Anning call for a final solution, and all these dominant voices that run the show and write history, draft policies and set agendas, do so at the expense of minorities without a platform for them to counteract these outcomes. I recall in 2016, Pauline Hanson's speech about being swamped by Muslims and calling for a Muslim ban. She then claimed she was being silenced. In the ensuing 24 hours, over seven different media outlets and platforms she received, she kept telling everyone how she had no voice. The There is something essentially depraved about deeming Islam a disease and extolling racism as a virtue. But this is where we're at. When challenged, the reaction of white fragility is to claim they are being silenced, with their finger on the pulse of systems and centuries of oppression and political and economic privilege, really. Calling out these abuses of privilege isn't enough. Entitlement enables casual misogyny, homophobia, and racism to penetrate conversations, which fast become the bigoted commentary and behaviours we're exposed to, and often the legislation and we inherit and the violence we experience. Surely a bigot's right could not outweigh my right to human dignity. Now, it should not be my responsibility to assist a racist leader unpack or negotiate their racism about Muslims or refugees or Indigenous Australians. Racism is not part of Maslow's hierarchy of needs. It cannot be justified as a means of survival or self-actualization. And it can no longer be the burden of the marginalized to repeatedly demonstrate their humanity as a defense against this unlawful hate. Bigotry needs to be called out. Pundits need to step aside from the platforms where they dissect, debate, and negotiate the very people they exclude from speaking. We've long lamented the fear and threat to ourselves and minorities as Australian Muslims in this country from right-wing supremacy. In response to our calls, though, to hear this threat, we were told, bigots have rights. Free speech is a cornerstone of our democracy. We're not a racist country. Don't be divisive. Stop being confronting. Stay in your lane, don't just integrate. Be alert, not alarmed. Jihadi watch in schools. Illegal asylum seekers. Refugees are dog lodgers, but refugees are stealing our jobs. Refugees are taking our hospital beds. Lose the identity politics, man. Love it or leave it. Ban the burqa, ban immigration, ban Muslims. Ban halal, ban Sharia, ban the boats. Islam is not a race, blah, blah, blah. And we need a final solution. So, when white supremacists massacred 51 Muslims during Friday prayer on 15th of March 2019, Australian Muslims were horrified but not shocked. In many ways, we expected this. We knew it was coming. How could we not? Thank you.
You're with Paul Barclay on RN, and this is Big Ideas. Broadcast, podcast, and on the ABC Listen app.
Tom Switzer is director of libertarian think tank, the Centre for Independent Studies. He thinks that racism in Australia is confined to the fringes of public discourse and not the mainstream.
I happened to be in New Zealand a few days afterwards, and it was very clear that the shock to the country's public consciousness will echo for years. However, the bodies had hardly been found before social media ran the line that the culprit behind the Christchurch atrocity, apart from the obvious madman, was Australia's public discourse. And the argument, and you've already heard it from Tim and Tasneen, is that an entrenched racism in Australia fuels Islamophobia and other forms of bigotry, and that in turn helps motivate right-wing extreme violence. Is this a persuasive argument? Well, the conventional wisdom in the media in the last 3 weeks would suggest yes. But I would argue that racism and xenophobia, far from defining the political mainstream, is by and large confined to the fringes of Australia's public discourse. And the reaction across the country to March 15, I would argue, is powerful proof. Indeed, the widespread outpouring of support for Christchurch's Muslim community, and indeed Muslims in the wider Australian community, has been a rebuke to those who commit violence in the name of race, and to those who think Australia is irredeemably racist. It's my view this evening that for all our nation's flaws, including the appalling treatment of our Indigenous population in the past, and notwithstanding those pockets of bigotry and racism that do exist in this country, Australia, all things considered, is broadly a liberal, tolerant, multicultural society. And it's been that way for the best part of half a century, since both major political parties chipped away at the great white walls of white Australia and moved quickly to enshrine the multicultural ideal as the basis of national community. Whenever a political figure goes outside the bounds of respectability, either on race or religion, or both, there are multiple countering voices. As the University of Sydney historian James Curran told me this week, quote, "You don't have to agree with all their arguments, but their reaction to the extremes is telling in its own right about the foundational decency and respect on which the current Australian community is built." Now, Tim has said that there has never been a better time to be a dog-whistling politician or a race-baiting commentator. And he gave you some examples. Well, as Tim acknowledged, just ask Michael Daly. He dog-whistled. A week before the recent New South Wales election, it was widely believed that Daly would win power or at least a minority Labor government. That all changed when Daly's early remarks about Asian immigrants stealing Australian jobs surfaced. He had breached the post-white Australia consensus. The result? The Labor leader lost the election and copped a 12% swing in his own safe seat. He's now damaged goods, having just lost the leadership of the Labor Party. And meanwhile, a lady from an immigrant family with a long name, Gladys Berejiklian, has stolen what he believed was his job. Tim mentions Ross Cameron, and Tim's right. It was an appalling lack of judgment, to put it mildly, to say on air a few months ago about black-haired, slanty-eyed, yellow-skinned Chinese. But this is the good news. Sky News immediately sacked him. And then there's Fraser Anning, who has about as much sophistication and subtlety as one Donald Trump. Yet as offensive as the Queensland Senator is, remember he only won 19 first preference Senate votes at the last federal elections, and moreover, although Anning's maiden address was offensive, remember all of those speeches for the censure motion on both sides of the political divide, shunning Fraser Anning. So if racism were really dominating the political mainstream, how does one account for the fact that all these views, the Daly's, the Camerons, the Annings, they're widely condemned by the body politic? Isn't that a good development? Now, there are other ways of demonstrating our strong support for a liberal and tolerant multiracial society. Immigration. As I pointed out earlier, we have come a long way since the days of white Australia. That period from the mid-60s until the early 1970s, not even a decade, we radically transformed our immigration policy. Nearly half of our population today is either born overseas or has a parent who was born overseas. More than a third of our migrant intake comes from Asia, and another 20% comes from the Middle East and Africa. Bear this in mind when assessing charges of racism against Australian governments. Now, many of you may recall the incident that Tasneen mentioned in 2001, the so-called Tampa asylum seeker standoff. And at the time, John Howard's slogan, as I think Tanzine recalled, was, "We will determine who comes to this country and the circumstances in which they come." Now, many of the same people who say that the Morrisons and the Duttons, who are fanning the flames of xenophobia and racism, they were saying the same thing about John Howard and Philip Ruddock, his then immigration minister. But Howard's declaration was not, "We will have no migrants," nor was it we will turn migrants back home from where they came from. That would have been the cries of a genuine populist, nativist and xenophobe. Howard's words were, we determine who comes here. Now, for his supporters, Howard's action was a highly reassuring event. Writing in the quarterly essay published by Black Ink Books around that time, my late friend John Hurst, who was a longtime professor of political science here at La Trobe University, he wrote, Howard's broad appeal was not to race or xenophobia. It was a declaration that Australia still existed and could still take charge of its own destiny. And Hurst's point was that the tough measures put in place helped boost public confidence in our immigration system. And so, for the rest of Howard's tenure, legal, non-discriminatory immigration more than doubled. Bear this in mind when assessing charges that Australia is anti-immigrant. In Europe, by contrast, a policy of open doors has led to a sense of helplessness, which in turn has led to the rise of genuinely far-right nativist movements. And the xenophobia there is not confined to the fringes. This is the New York Times. Quote, the Czech president has called Muslim immigrants criminals. The head of Poland's governing party has said refugees are riddled with disease. The leader of Hungary has described migrants as poison, and it goes on. Our political leaders, not the fringes, they don't talk that language. In 2015, at the height of the Syrian civil war, Prime Minister Tony Abbott, backed by the Labor opposition, welcomed 12,000 refugees from the Middle East on top of our yearly refugee intake. And our leaders welcomed the Syrian refugees in an orderly, measured way, and this is important, with the broad support of the public. Tasneem has complained that when terror incidents occur, our political leaders target Muslim communities. And Tim, in his book on hate, says they make political mileage out of tough rhetoric against Muslims. Well, if anything, our political leaders go out of their way to link any jihadist attack or jihadist threat to, quote, violent extremist outfits like Al-Qaeda, like Jamaat Islamiyah, like ISIS or ISIL or Islamic State. They don't target the entire Muslim community. They target extremists and radicals and some of those Muslim clerics who do indeed aid and abet their cause, not just here, but in many parts of the Western world. So in conclusion, obviously Australia has its flaws. Many of the comments that have been made are repugnant. But Australia has a lot of great strengths. And one of them, as I've tried to make clear, has been our wonderful capacity to integrate so many people of different races and faiths into the broader population. Now, none of this is to deny that successive waves of immigration have each aroused anxiety at various stages. You think about the Greeks and the Italians in the 50s, Vietnamese in the 70s, and Middle Easterners in more recent times. That is true. I'm not going to deny that. Nor am I going to deny the rise of far-right nationalist movements that Tim talked about. The question we have to ask ourselves is, why is this happening? Is it happening because of what Scott Morrison may or may not have said in Shadow Cabinet in 2011? Or because of Pauline Hanson's offensive and silly stunt about why it's okay to be white? Or why, whether Sky After Dark invited some right-wing nutball onto the news network? Or does a more plausible explanation for the rise of these nasty groups lie in understanding the very real backlash against the progressive prosecution of identity politics in the Western world? I also recognise, just finally, that Tim's right about very few minority CEOs in Australia, in our business, in our media world. I think if you compare our television presenters in this country with Great Britain and especially the United States, it's chalk and cheese. It's a fair point. But I also believe, given the dramatic progress we've made since the end of White Australia, there'll be more Jeremy Fernandes's, there'll be more Karina Cavallo's, there'll be more Waleed Ali's, and there'll be more Tim Soutphommasane's and more Shemara Wickramana Yakes in our media and business world. After all, given the relatively recent transition from White Australia to multiculturalism, we've made tremendous progress. Just look at our society's determination to banish racists and xenophobes from the political mainstream. Thank you.
Associate Professor Chelsea Bond, Senior Research Fellow at the University of Queensland, brings in the Indigenous perspective. And for her, racism is an everyday experience.
Look, I'd like to acknowledge Dr. Marie Pardy and the 170 or so academics who authorised the open letter to La Trobe objecting to this forum in its original form, which was originally a debate between Tom and Tim about whether Australia is still racist. Those opposed specifically requested that the debate be reorganised as a forum that considers the extent and modes of racism in Australia today and how these might be addressed, and secondly, that the speaker list include a minimum of Indigenous and Muslim speakers. And while I think the question effectively has remained the same, about 2 weeks ago I did receive an invitation, and here I am. I wish to speak to my decision to participate in this forum, not that I owe anyone an explanation as a black fella as to why I might have something to say about racism, but I'm conscious that for some my presence here may well be read as some kind of validation of the problematic assumptions that frame this forum this evening, including that which is contained within the question. But don't worry, I will follow the brief and I'll answer the question, but rest assured it won't take me 15 minutes. I'm not here to be part of an equity project as the Indigenous participant accessorising this event. When Ahmed speaks of being the feminist killjoy, I think of myself as the black speed bump of the capital B kind. A cautionary disruption to an otherwise smooth ride. I also reassure myself and those around me that the real inconvenience in my uncomfortable presence is not experienced by those that ride roughshod over me. It will always be my body that will bear the brunt and carry the weight. So whatever inconvenience or disruption is experienced in this next little while, rest assured that the weight I carry will be far heavier. But I do so with the genuine hope of carving out more productive and critical conversations about race as an oppressive structure to enable strategising around how we might undermine it, as it continues to bear down heavy on the lives of blackfellas in this country every single day. So let's get the question out of the way. The question is fundamentally flawed because it's premised on the idea that racism is an artefact of a bygone era and as something that is external to Australian political life. Australian history has more than a racial dimension. Race has been foundational to this country. It arrived on the ships in 1788 along with the convicts, marines, seamen and civil officers when we first became known as their Aborigines. It was the enabler to the illegal acquisition of our land. Race was the means by which we were named and claimed. In fact, as Goldberg points out, European expansion across the globe was rationalised in racial terms. More than moral judgments, ideas of race were empirical descriptions. Here, race was turned into a foundational code cemented in place by scientists and philosophers, writers and literary critics, public intellectuals and artists, journalists and clergy, politicians and bureaucrats, each of which became the day labourers or bricklayers of racial foundations. In our becoming Aborigines, we have been known by them and through our relationship to them, cementing a relationship of power over us, physically, morally, intellectually, politically, and legislatively. We simply cannot talk about racism without talking about race and its origins as foundational to this society. We need to look no further than the Constitution and the race power, which claim to regulate the affairs of the people of colour, coloured or inferior races who are in the Commonwealth, which, of course, excluded us as blackfellas, because we were meant to die out. Via race, we were and were soon to become non-existent. This race power enabled the new parliament as one of its first acts to restrict non-white, non-British immigration, which of course was sustained up until the 1950s through to the 1970s. At this same time, Aboriginal peoples in Queensland were subjected to the restriction of the sale of opium and protection of Aborigines Act, in which all Aboriginal people were made wards of the state from the 1890s through to the 1970s. with almost every aspect of our lives controlled by the state. Relocated off our lands, children removed, and labour exploited as a means of protection in our passing. This is my father's generation. And there is not one black fella in the state of Queensland who can describe their family tree to you without referencing that legislation. Hence, this talk of lone wolves and racism suddenly entering the political mainstream are absurd to black fellas. Thank you. I was fortunate that I was born just a few years after the enactment of the Racial Discrimination Act, and I have successfully tested state legislation in my own community of Inala. But in my lifetime, I've also witnessed the suspension of the Racial Discrimination Act on three separate occasions, and each and every time, it was only in relation to Aboriginal people. And strangely enough, it was to do with land every time. Not women and children, as they'd have you believe. Just last week, Senator Pat Dodson, in addressing the censure motion against Fraser Anning, powerfully stated, "Our First Nations peoples have carried the consequences of murderous prejudice throughout our entwined history." He goes on to point out, "We know what it's like to be powerless in the face of hateful prejudice, fanned by the illusion of superiority and the false courage created by a weapon in the hand of an oppressor." Senator Dodson was not playing identity politics. He was testifying to the violence of racism upon black fellas here in this country, and he reminds us of the unique vantage point of Indigenous peoples in our ability to illuminate understandings of race and racism in this country. It is thus interesting to me that my presence here, as someone who is First Nations and First Raced, finds myself last placed in a conversation about race right now. This positioning is neither a mistake or a coincidence. Not human, intellectually inferior, childlike, dying and doomed, from missing link to lowest rung. Black fellas have felt the full brunt of the violence of racism in all of its forms, and we know too well that it's not aberrational, but rather foundational, which has always and only ever been predicated upon our non-existence. The same ideology that refuses to recognise black existence is the same which fails to see black excellence and black intelligence. Right now. I found most revealing the organisers' original claim in the promotion of this event that Tim and Tom were, and I quote, "the two most important voices on this debate on racism." I couldn't find evidence of Tom's scholarly work around race and racism except some opinion pieces that appear to diminish or downplay its existence. And I mean, it's fine to have an opinion, but as an academic, a little more is required of me. And as a black fella, a hell of a lot more is required of me to occupy the position of Noah, regardless of how articulate and how intelligent I actually am. It was telling here that in the introductions online, I was positioned as a distinguished academic who has worked in Indigenous health promotion, culture, identity and community development, who, like everyone else, is a close observer of Australian political culture, which is true, and it's a line in my bio. But it struck me, if they were going to take a line from my bio, why wouldn't it be the line about my current research, which aims to advance our understandings of race in contemporary Indigenous public health discourse and practice? Surely my scholarly work around race would be more relevant than my work around identity, culture and health promotion. Meanwhile, the other most important voice on the realness of racism is the former Race Discrimination Commissioner, who has publicly claimed that the Northern Territory Emergency Response and later the Stronger Solutions Policy in the Northern Territory, although racisty, was okay because it was for a worthwhile cause. And he too brought the line that it was about sexual abuse in Aboriginal communities. And while it's pleasing to hear Tim take a stronger position on matters pertaining to race, having left the post, his final speech as Race Discrimination Commissioner made only two mentions of Indigenous peoples, both in our relation to our experiences of racism, as being stopped in stores or subjected to searches or being denied services by businesses and taxis. There is a passing reference to institutional racism as a legacy of colonial racism, but he does not unpack or explore how that manifests or what we should do, but instead testifies to growing up in the heartland of multicultural Sydney and extolling the virtue of the Racial Discrimination Act, stating, "It has given Australians of all backgrounds a means of holding racial discrimination to account." But if only that were the case. As a student of history and politics, I'm sure Tom will tell you about the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Protection Act of 1984, the Native Title Amendment Act of 1998, and of course, we know about the Northern Territory National Emergency Response of 2007, all of which required suspending that Racial Discrimination Act. So I don't know why we're not telling the truth about the Racial Discrimination Act, not actually holding racial discrimination to account, specifically for blackfellas, in our land, from South Australia to the Torres Strait to the Northern Territory. In our continued presence, blackfellas are the uncomfortable truth that this nation must reconcile itself with. We are the most courageous when it comes to conversations about race, having copped the full brunt of its violence. But also because we have nothing else left to lose, literally. In my being, I refuse to bear false witness to these lies. Racism deniers and model migrants, regardless of their academic track record, will never advance our collective understanding of race in this country, and nor will debates framed on false binaries about whether racism is real or situating the battleground between the left and the right side of politics. Race has worked for the settlers regardless of which political party is in power. One might feel a little less racist-y, but it doesn't mean it is. The ongoing racialised inequalities experienced by Indigenous peoples tells us so, as does the refusal to meaningfully negotiate coexistence across this continent. As blackfellas, in coming to these conversations about race, we do more than just testify about our existence and our experience. We've long theorised these bruises upon our bodies and the social, cultural, political and economic conditions of our communities. Foregrounding blackfellas' contributions to critical race scholarship will illuminate in a far more sophisticated way our understanding of race, which intellectually is still centred around the Northern Hemisphere. We need to develop for ourselves an understanding of racism that attends to race as a structure of oppression, rather than as a matter of individual prejudices or attitudes, one that focuses on facts over feelings, and that foregrounds Indigenous sovereignty rather than diversity, tolerance, inclusion and multiculturalism. It is only through advancing our understanding of race, rather than debating its existence, that we can undermine the very real and ongoing effects of racism, if we genuinely despise it as much as we say we do. If I can conclude by returning to the question that brought us here tonight, has racism in contemporary Australia entered the political mainstream? Let me just say the real question we should be asking is, when will it leave? But the truth is, it will stay as long as the settlers do. For they are the ones most emotionally attached to an ideological commitment to race. And herein lies the opportunity and the obligation of academic institutions in the colony to foster sophisticated and intelligent conversations about how race and racism operate right here and right now, and not leave it to a few good, and perhaps some might say, mediocre men and their opinions. Thank you.
Chelsea Bond, and before her, Tom Switzer, Tasneem Chopra, and Tim Soupamasan. Racism in Australia was the topic of the second La Trobe University debates. I'm Paul Barclay. Thanks for listening. Bye for now.
Listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.